This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
When our water heater broke down last month, it was a nightmare. It took 5 hours for the plumber to show up, and he charged us a couple of $100 just to come out. Then it cost another $1,800 to put in the new water heater. By the time it was all said and done, I felt like I'd been taken. But what else could I do?
The smartest thing you can do is get a home warranty from American Residential Warranty. Their home warranties pay to repair or replace all your major appliances when they break. And they will break, and at the worst possible time. Call American Residential Warranty right now for free information on home warranties starting at just pennies a day. Don't wait for your refrigerator to stop running or your ceiling fans to stop turning. Call American Residential Warranty right now. Ask how you can save up to 50% on washer and dryer coverage. Just call 1-800-686-3910. That's 1-800-686-3910. Again, 1-800-686-3910. Call now.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Thank you very much for joining. Great to have you with me. A lot happened over the weekend, so we have a lot to get to today. Of course, there was a GOP debate. Oh, yeah. Saturday night. And I have to tell you, I did not watch the GOP debate live. I watched it the next day, and I tried, sort of like somebody that tapes a sporting event and doesn't want to know the final score, I tried to avoid any and all commentary from the commentariat, from the commentators out there, the chattering classes. I tried to avoid it until after I had already watched for myself. But it was tough not to get a sense that something had gone awry for our buddy Marco Rubio. Maybe he's not your buddy, but something happened with Marco Rubio in this debate that was very clearly not helpful to his overall prospects. Let's just say in New Hampshire, if not in the overall race for the GOP nomination. He's been accused in the past of being a little plastic, a little too rehearsed, refined, some even say memorized. Every time he gives an answer to a debate question, it sounds like it's something that he was preparing in the mirror the night before. That's what some say. Others say he's a gifted politician and his rhetoric just soars and inspires and they love it. Well, whichever one of those sides you fall on doesn't really matter. I think you'll probably agree that he ran into a bit of a brick wall here. He kept repeating something over and over. Some of you have probably already heard this. You've seen this, but I have to play it for you because why, Marco? Why? This was his response to different questions at different points and all in about the first 30 or 40 minutes of the debate. This is what he said over and over. Play clip 3.
Let's dispel once and for all with this fiction that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing. We are not facing a president that doesn't know what he's doing. He knows what he is doing. So let's dispel with this fiction that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing. Anyone who believes that Barack Obama isn't doing what he's doing on purpose doesn't understand what we're dealing with here.
Okay, we get it. He thinks that Barack Obama is intentionally destroying the country. He thinks Barack Obama knows what he's doing. Barack Obama is causing these problems purposefully. He thinks that this is, in fact, all the result of Obamaism, intentional Obamaism. But he didn't have to keep saying it like that over and over again, and yet he did. He did. He said it the same time 4 times, which just frankly seemed weird. I don't understand. There are some debate flubs that happen. There are some things that can happen in debate, and you say to yourself, well, I can understand. That was a tough question, or that was just a difficult moment, or sometimes you just have a little brain slip up, right? You say something you didn't mean to say, or it just comes out funny. You're talking for hours on end. Look, I do radio, right? I do this unscripted. I'm sitting here speaking to you. Something I might say something or mispronounce something, stutter into something. Any number of things happen all the time, right? This wasn't that. This seemed very intentional, and I'm only focusing on it because people are saying this is the end of the Rubio surge, such as it was. I'm not sure that's true. It seems like he's still competitive, not with Trump, but with the rest of the also-ran field in New Hampshire. And he's even gone as far as to defend himself on the Sunday show, saying that, yeah, that's he wanted to repeat himself over and over. Play clip four.
What went wrong?
Well, actually, I would pay them to keep running that clip because that's what I believe passionately. It's one of the reasons why I'm not running for re-election to the Senate and I'm running for president. This notion and this idea that somehow all this is an accident. Obamacare was not an accident. Dodd-Frank was not an accident. The deal with Iran was not an accident.
But you're getting pounded for repeating that speech.
Well, look, we raised more money last night in the first hour of that debate than any other debate. As far as that message, I hope they keep running it. And I'm going to keep saying it because it's true.
So it's not just a question. It's not just a question that they doubled down here. They have quadrupled down. They have quadrupled down, or maybe even quintupled down at this point, on Marco Rubio saying that Barack Obama. By the way, who's running around saying that this is all an accident? I'm also not familiar with that line of analysis, that this all just sort of happened and nobody meant for it to happen. Of course, that's not the case. So he's repeating something that to me seems obvious. He's repeating something in a way that was bizarre. This was the main takeaway that many had, at least for Marco Rubio, from the debate. Can he bounce back from it? We'll see. New Hampshire's tomorrow. We'll have some. We'll have a Blaze reporter from up in New Hampshire telling us what's going on the ground tomorrow. Give you all the latest on that. But certainly a lot of people are going to say, just as they now say that Trump staying out of the debate before Iowa may have cost him Iowa, that Marco Rubio's mechanical repetition of this Obama line, that may have been what did him in New Hampshire, at least. There were some other interesting moments. By the way, it seemed to be I heard some others saying this as well. The governors tended to have a pretty good night, at least for the governors. Kasich, Christie, Jeb. Notice that he's just Jeb. Exclamation point. We won't use his last name. Bush. But the governors had a pretty good night in the debate, at least for who they are. Now, I think Christie had the strongest night of all of them, and it was in part because he was the one that really threw Rubio off his game in a way that was very memorable. And Christie may now be more competitive, at least for a fourth place finish in New Hampshire as a result of his debate performance. Even Kasich had his moments. Bush went on a little bit of a tear about the 10th Amendment that sounded pretty good. I know some of you are going to have to cover your ears. I'm going to play you a Bush clip, but here's Bush on the 10th Amendment. Play clip 11.
I agree with everything that's been said here about repealing unconstitutional rules and rules that are creating real burdens for investing that creates jobs. But we also ought to get back to being a 10th Amendment country as well, a country that respects the states to be able to make more decisions. And in the Bush administration, we would shift transportation dollars back to the states. I trust Kasich and Christie to build the roads and the infrastructure of their states than Washington, D.C. EPA delegated authority back to the states. Education dollars back to the states. I would like to see reform take place all across the country where there's more vouchers, more freedom. If we did that, we would shrink government's power in Washington, D.C., and we would have a much more effective government where people would begin to trust our government again, because now no one believes it works.
Now, I know a lot of you don't like Jeb. In fact, I don't know if any of you like Jeb. But he had a couple of good moments in the debate. I'm just assessing how I think the debate went and how it will affect New Hampshire, right? I still like to think of myself as above the fray. I have not picked a candidate yet. I have a couple of favorites, obviously, but I have not, or a few favorites maybe, but I have not yet decided who I would vote for. And I'm going to hold out for as long as I can. I'm going to play hard to get with these GOP candidates. Nonetheless, Jeb had his strongest debate, I think, probably so far. And so did Chris Christie. And I won't make you listen to the Kasich clip because I take pity on your ears. But I will say that he probably had a better night than he had had previously. Will it matter? We'll see. The numbers are pretty close on those candidates. The governors and Rubio all battling it out. And the narrative going into South Carolina, if Rubio doesn't have a strong finish, is going to be that third establishment slot is still up for grabs. Who's it going to be? We know there's going to be Cruz and Trump in this thing for a while. Who's going to be the third way in this race? People had thought it was Rubio until this debate, and now maybe it's not so much Rubio anymore. Maybe it's going to be somebody else. Maybe it's Christie. It's possible. Jeb is spending tons of money, so maybe Jeb still thinks he's got a prayer, though I don't. And by the way, I mentioned Senator Ted Cruz. Had a solid night. Not his best night, but a solid night, in my opinion. Did pretty well. Gave us the usual Ted Cruz that many of you, I know and love. But he did a good job. And I think there was one point of the debate that will stand out in most minds as most important for Ted Cruz, because, look, we all know he's got the intellectual firepower. We all know he's got the background, the credentials, scholarly, legal, and just in general, a sterling resume and also a history of standing up to the establishment. And he's a guy that people, whether they like him or not on a personal level, he's supposed to be somebody who is trustworthy, who follows through on what he says he's going to do. And he had a very powerful moment, I think, in this debate where he discussed a personal issue, because one of the failings, at least according to Ted Cruz's critics, one of his failings is his inability to emote or to sort of connect on an emotional level with voters. And New Hampshire has this terrible problem of heroin addiction, which I must be honest with you, until this election, I didn't know this. I didn't know that New Hampshire was so troubled by heroin addiction. And it is a widespread and very serious. It's really a pandemic of sorts in the northeastern quarter of the United States. And Cruz has a personal history of having somebody in his family dealing with this. He lost a half-sister to addiction. And when he spoke about this, I think that people saw a side of him that was real, was earnest, and was powerful. Play clip six.
My older sister, Miriam, who was my half-sister, struggled her whole life with drug and alcohol addiction. My father and her mom divorced when she was a little girl, and she was angry her whole life. And she ended up marrying a man who'd been in and out of jail. She then became a single mom, and she herself went to jail several times, and she ended up spending some time in a crack house. I still remember my father and me driving up to get Miriam out of that crack house to try to convince her she needed to be a mom to my nephew Joey. She wasn't willing to listen. She was not willing to change the path she was on. She was angry. I had just gotten my first job coming out of law school. I took a $20,000 loan on a credit card to put my nephew Joey in Valley Forge Military Academy. He was in sixth grade at the time, to pay his way through that. And about 5-6 years ago, Miriam died of an overdose. It was, the coroner ruled it accidental. We don't know. She went to sleep one night, had taken too many pills, and Joey walked in and found her dead. This is an absolute epidemic. We need leadership to solve it. Solving it has to occur at the state and local level with programs like AA and counseling and churches and charities, but it also has to occur securing the borders, because you've got Mexican cartels that are smuggling vast amounts of heroin into this country. We know how to secure the borders. What is missing is the political will to do it. And as president, I will secure the border. We will end this deluge of drugs that is flowing over our southern border and that is killing Americans across this country.
I think it was Ted Cruz's. I played the whole thing for you because I thought it was powerful. I think that was his best moment of the entire debate. And I think that was a moment that he will be remembered for quite some time. People have said that he's robotic. He's too, sort of similar to Rubio criticisms, that he's too mechanical, overly rehearsed, too refined in his speech. And it all sounds somewhat disingenuous because it all sounds so fluid and eloquent at the same time, like he's reading it off a sheet of paper. It's almost too good. It's strange. It doesn't seem like the kind of conversation you'd have with your friend. It's always like he's in a declamation competition. He's trying to give the greatest speech since the Gettysburg Address, right? This is what people say about Ted Cruz. And you could say, in a sense, it's because, well, he's operating at a very high level and he's not speaking to people like they're fourth graders. So there's that. But in this moment, you saw Ted Cruz in a way that it was personalized, that policy and politics has real meaning for him as a human being. It has real meaning within his family. And you saw that he understands that having the sort of power that one would have if he were to become commander in chief, having the ability perhaps to save lives, to prevent this from happening, to prevent more deaths like the death of his half-sister from drug addiction by stopping the flow from the cartels across the border, by helping with treatment programs. I think you saw a side of Ted Cruz that people will remember for quite some time, because it was real and it did come from the heart. And I think it's important that Ted Cruz remind people of that, that he has, he's a husband, he's a father, and he's known loss and struggle too. It's not just, he's not just the golden boy who went to Princeton and Harvard and made his way all the way through without any trouble. He's had his trials and tribulations. He's had loss. He's had pain. And he understands the grave burden that would be on his shoulders would he be if he were to become commander-in-chief. Switching gears for a second, team. If you're looking for a silencer for your firearm, I've got the best option possible for you. Silencershop.com. All you have to do is go to silencershop.com and you follow the step-by-step instructions. You watch videos and reviews, and then you make your selection. You've got the most popular brands to choose from, and you can make your purchase right there on silencershop.com. They will handle all the details, and your nearest Powered by Silencer Shop dealer will call you when your silencer is ready. Silencers are a good thing to have. They just make it a little more enjoyable for you during shooting sports. You can wear little or no hearing protection. It's great for hunters. It's great for those out on the range. It's just worth checking out. SilencerShop.com also offers easy financing. In fact, they return your finance charge as a gift certificate after your final payment. So help make the world a quieter place. Visit SilencerShop.com to find a silencer for your firearm. Back after this break.
Buck Sexton, dispensing the truth.
On the Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, there were some interesting moments with the Donald during the debate. I did not think he had, even for Trump, a particularly strong debate. I think even if you were a Trump supporter watching this thing, it was tough to think that he did his best work. He didn't pull off the full Trump. It was kind of not really a funny moment. I didn't think it was a little petulant at different parts. I'm just being honest with you. I didn't think it was good. Even for Trump, I didn't think it was good. But if you hate Trump all the time, well, then obviously you thought it was particularly terrible, but didn't do a very good job. At one point he said he would bring back, I didn't know what this meant, by the way. This was interesting to me. He was asked about waterboarding, and sorry, step back for a second. So ABC's running this debate. You've got Raddatz, you've got the guy, sort of Ken doll-looking guy, I forget his name, whatever his name is, Muir. Good hair, got to respect it. But he's up there, they're asking these questions. You'll notice the questions they ask are either pointed at other Republicans, meaning that they want them to attack each other, or they're very difficult questions that are intended to entrap Republicans in answers that could come back to haunt them. And just also the tone of them is very, are you ready for this job? There's a lot of that. You know, why are you ready for this job? Has anyone ever asked Bernie Sanders if he's ready for this job? Or Hillary Clinton? Madam Secretary, what accomplishments do you actually have in your background that make people think that you'd be a good president? I mean accomplishments. Now, you could say that she would have an answer to that question, Hillary Clinton would, and I would say, sure, she would. But just the very notion of being asked that question implies a certain cutting somebody down at the knees a little bit, just a little bit. There was a lot of that going on, if you go back and watch it. And it wasn't really that subtle. There was a lot of, since you Republicans are all a bunch of nut jobs, and since none of you is really in a position to run for the presidency in a way that's serious, let's ask you a question now. But they asked them about waterboarding, which has Hillary or Bernie been asked about waterboarding in the entire time in their debates? I don't know. I'd have to go back and look. They were asked about waterboarding, and Trump said that he would bring back waterboarding and worse. Play clip 8.
Well, I'll tell you what. In the Middle East, we have people chopping the heads off Christians. We have people chopping the heads off many other people. We have things that we have never seen before as a group. We have never seen before what's happening right now. The medieval times. I mean, we studied medieval times. Not since medieval times have people seen what's going on. I would bring back waterboarding, and I'd bring back a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding.
I don't know what that means, but he I don't even know. I don't even know what that worse than waterboarding. Well, like what? Let's see if we can get clip five in there. So he explained himself yesterday on morning shows. Go.
I want to play something you said that raised a lot of eyebrows. It was about waterboarding. Here it is.
I would bring back waterboarding, and I'd bring back a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding.
Okay. What's the worst?
Well, you didn't see what I said before that. What I said before that was, in the Middle East, you have people chopping off other people's heads. Mm-hmm. This hasn't happened since medieval times. There's never been anything like this. So I talked about that. And then I said, and by the way, waterboarding is peanuts compared to what we're talking about happening.
Okay.
So
we get it. He's not contextualizing it. Donald, not a strong performance. More coming up.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
When our water heater broke down last month, it was a nightmare. It took 5 hours for the plumber to show up, and he charged us a couple of $100 just to come out. Then it cost another $1,800 to put in the new water heater. By the time it was all said and done, I felt like I'd been taken. But what else could I do?
The smartest thing you can do is get a home warranty from American Residential Warranty. Their home warranties pay to repair or replace all your major appliances when they break. And they will break, and at the worst possible time. Call American Residential Warranty right now for free information on home warranties starting at just pennies a day. Don't wait for your refrigerator to stop running or your ceiling fans to stop turning. Call American Residential Warranty right now. Ask how you can save up to 50% on washer and dryer coverage. Just call 1-800-686-3910. That's 1-800-686-3910. Again, 1-800-686-3910. Call now.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, it wasn't just on the Republican side of things that there were some interesting moments over the week, and the Democrats had a few worthwhile spats, some interesting missteps worthy of a few moments of our time. Hillary Clinton is supposed to have a lock on female voters. She's supposed to be able to count on female voters, at least in her mind and the mind of many Democrats, that there's really no competition here, that there should be no moment of pause for any woman, right? It should just be vote your gender. That's what they're hoping will happen. It is not necessarily happening. And in fact, one of the big problems for the Clinton campaign coming in the aftermath of the Iowa caucuses is that women under 30, so women in their 20s, went for Bernie by a huge margin, by 70 points. They're going for Bernie. And this is, of course, a problem for some on the left and some feminists on the left who say that, oh, they're just can't imagine how any woman would not go this, not go that route. You have Gloria Steinem, feminist movement. I would not say feminist icon because I don't think she deserves to control that term, but feminist movement icon, I suppose. She was on the Bill Maher show over the weekend. And she, do we have that clip, Ty? I don't know if we have it. She was on the Bill Maher show over the weekend, and she said that young women are going for Bernie because that's where the boys are. Oh, no, the horror. Now she says this, and this is terrible. How could she undermine women's, yeah, I don't think we have it. It's all right. Women's politics. How could she treat women in their 20s as being politically unserious? It was just a joke. But isn't there some irony here to a stone-faced feminist who usually has no sense of humor about these things making a little quip, and it comes back? And she didn't get the memo, by the way, that the left now eats its own, that no one is safe. No one is allowed to. Women aren't allowed to make anti-feminist jokes, even. Nobody gets a free pass. Everyone is subject to the dictates of the leftist mob, which change all the time, by the way. You never know if you're going to be on the right side of things or not. They're coming for you one way or another. She got caught up in that, and now she's had to go and apologize. Oh, of course, the necessary apology for anything said in the media. And that wasn't the only time we had this sort of moment of feminist angst coming through here. You also have
Madeleine Albright, who, by the way, that this woman was ever Secretary of State is still kind of a shock and astonishing to me, and not in a good way. But she was at a Hillary rally, and with Hillary standing right there next to her, having a sort of girl power moment, she said that there's a special place in, well, let me let her say it herself. Clip 14, go.
We can tell our story about how we climbed the ladder, and a lot of you younger women don't think you have to. It's been done. It's not done. And you have to help. Hillary Clinton will always be there for you. And just remember, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other.
Oh, this is identity politics with an eternal damnation twist to it. Special place in hell for those who don't help, for women who don't help other women. Interesting that I suppose this line of logic doesn't apply to Carly Fiorina. She's lost her woman card somewhere along the way. Doesn't count. She doesn't count. Clinton also is trying to trot out some of these very tired tropes about feminism. She's doing her level best to find some way to gather enthusiasm around her candidacy, which even if she wins, it's going to be a Democratic Party, by and large, that votes for her while holding their nose and turning their face away. Just, they realize the best they can do is their only shot at winning. But she says that the media unfairly criticizes her when she shouts because of, oh, that's right, you know what's coming, sexism. Clip 15.
We are still living with a double standard, and I know it. Every woman I know knows it, whether you're in the media as a woman or you're in the professions or business or politics. And I don't know anything other to do than just keep forging through it and just taking the slings and arrows that come with being a woman in the arena. You know, sometimes I talk soft, sometimes I get passionate and I get a little bit excited. I don't know any man who doesn't do the same thing. And I find it sort of interesting that all of a sudden this is a big discussion about me once again.
No, it's really more that she just has a horrible voice. It is painful to listen to. And when she yells, it is a violation of my eardrums. And I feel like there should be compensation for it. It's not right. It's not fair. Her voice is terrible. Now, this is not her fault. But if she were a lovely person of tremendous integrity, I think her voice would bother me less. But her voice is objectively awful and grating. And I'm somebody who spends a fair amount of time thinking about people's voices. So her voice is the worst. It's not about sexism. It's just about eardrums and what eardrums like and don't like. So she's terrible on that front. But more importantly, you can put all of that aside. Hillary wants to have it both ways. Hillary wants to both use her status as a woman for gain, right, to sort of trot it out there and say, well, I'm a woman, therefore other women should vote for me, and also wants to say that people won't vote for me because I'm a woman. You see, there's a double standard. It's a negative. This is the same person who in the Democrat debate, which I had to watch because then I went on a panel with a bunch of Democrats and talked about it. Some of you may have seen part of that. That was interesting. This is somebody who says that she's not part of the establishment because she's a woman. She takes that as a one-stop shop excuse for, oh, no, I'm not part of the big E establishment because I'm a woman. She's Hillary Clinton, former first lady, former senator, former secretary of state, part of the Clinton dynasty and the Clinton incorporated multinational corporation that they pretend is a charity, but is really just a giant exercise in branding and cronyism for the Clintons. And she says that because she's a woman, you know, she's not establishment. This is just very base, low, unserious stuff from her. But at this point, her supporters, I think, more and more realize, or not even her supporters, Democrats realize there is no other option. They're going to have to vote for Hillary Clinton if they want to have a shot at the White House. Bernie Sanders is not going to win. I don't care what these polls say. I don't care that there are polls that say that Bernie and Hillary run neck and neck at the national level, or that Bernie would do as well against Republicans. I don't believe them. I will tell you that. I do not believe it. I do not believe that more than half of America would vote for a socialist right now. If Mayor Bloomberg gets in the race as an independent, if something crazy happens, well, then all bets are off. But if you have Bernie Sanders running against any Republican, I believe that the Republican wins by a lot. I don't believe Bernie Sanders can overcome his label as a socialist. I think that somebody who wants to run saying they're going to raise taxes on the middle class. We already have Obamacare, which is supposed to get universal coverage eventually. So what's he offering? Raising taxes on everybody who makes any money with the promise that you'll have universal coverage? It's just not enough. It just won't work. It's not going to play well enough in Ohio, in Florida, in Colorado, in Virginia, in the sorts of states that will be battlegrounds where he'll have to fight to win. It's just not going to happen. But Hillary says she's not establishment, and she's sending after Bernie Sanders, Bill Clinton. He's going around there now, and he's all, you know, Bernie's just, you know, he's his record, and, you know, he's bad, and I don't like him, and, you know, he gives me a funny look every time I hug a woman a little too close. He's like, you know, he's not one of the guys. I don't like him. Bill's out there saying nasty things about Bernie. He's been deployed now as a sort of anti-Bernie surrogate. I thought that Bill was going to be running the charity. I thought that he had other stuff. That's what we were told, that he was going to be focusing on other things, that Bill was going to be somebody who wasn't just going to be out there throwing punches on behalf of the Hillary campaign. But now he's out there calling Bernie Sanders sexist. Oh, isn't this a fascinating turn? You've got Bill Clinton, the serial philanderer, the sexual harasser and accused sexual assaulter, accused rapist, who's pointing fingers at Bernie Sanders, saying Bernie Sanders is sexist. Isn't this a bit rich? It was too much even for Morning Joe on MSNBC. When you're a Clinton and you got Morning Joe going after you pretty hard, you may have jumped the shark just a little bit on this stuff. Play clip 16 on Clinton and feminism.
Where were these women in 1998 when a young 22-year-old intern was taken advantage of in the Oval Office? And on top of that, Gloria Steinem.
That's fantastic.
Gloria Steinem wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in 1998 eviscerating Monica Lewinsky, Kathleen Willey, and all these other people. So, yes, I say, come on. When do you say there's a special place in hell if you don't support women?
Is it only
powerful women?
Yeah.
Like, is there a special place in hell for not supporting powerful women?
Are
22-year-old women that are being taken advantage of in the Oval Office not worthy of that same support?
Joe Scarborough's right. Like him or not, think he's conservative or not, whatever your take may be on Joe Scarborough, he's 100% right on this point. You cannot take that away from him. The feminists sold out women on behalf of Bill Clinton in the 90s, and now they turn around and they want to be a part of a rallying cry for Hillary? How many years later? How many women for Bill later, by the way? Apparently nobody is much interested in what Bill's been up to in recent years, that Hillary and Bill are in a sham marriage. No one cares about this. Isn't that fascinating? We had to hear about Mitt Romney having a family dog in a crate on top of the car as though that was some form of vile animal abuse from 40 years ago. But, you know, that was a character issue. But Bill Clinton in a completely fake and marriage of convenience. I mean, this is the kind of marriage where if this was for a green card, somebody would go to jail, right? This is a joke. It's not really a marriage anymore. But no one cares about this. No one's allowed to ask any questions. And we're all supposed to be told that Hillary's made it all on her own, that it's been so hard. No, Hillary is the classic coattail rider. Are we not allowed to say that? We're not supposed to say this? We're not allowed to point out the obvious truth here? That Hillary used her role as wife of a very powerful man to advance her own interests at the expense of all dignity, integrity, and truth? That she was a willing accomplice, covering up his lies, covering up his misdeeds, criminal, and just flatly immoral? None of this matters anymore? We're supposed to just let this all float down the river and forget that it happened? No, I say that that's not the way that this should go. And every time Hillary steps out and starts to make noises about how this is about women and women's rights, I think people should be reminded of the fact that she did not care much at all for women when her husband was abusing them. She did not care much at all for women shattering glass ceilings or being treated well in the workplace or sexual harassment or worse because it was in the way of the Clinton machine. Didn't matter. And that they would be so brazen and perhaps so desperate at this point as to deploy Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton on this issue. Somebody who has, to say he has zero credibility is to greatly understate the case. But it just goes to show you that modern feminism, just like the modern left is doing now across the board, it just falls into nonsensical hysteria after a while. It doesn't make any sense anymore. Even Gloria Steinem doesn't know what the rules are. It's anti-male, it's anti-life, it's anti-Christian, it's just anti-so many things. It's just about anger and power. And those are two things that you don't want mixed up together. But if it's only about anger and power and not principle, as we see, then yeah, sure. Use Bill Clinton. Have Hillary say whatever she has to say. Anything that works. That's the real Clinton motto. Whatever works. Even if it means that Hillary has to pretend that all of a sudden she cares about all women so much. We'll go into a break here, back right after.
Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Sexton Show.
One of the more interesting back and forths you can expect between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton is, of course, going to be on the issue of foreign policy. Clinton says that Sanders lacks a foreign policy network. He's not connected. Play clip two.
What's the difference between what you said about then-Senator Obama and what you're saying about Senator Sanders?
There's a very big difference. In 2008, Senator Obama had really done his homework in the Senate. He'd been there by that time a few years. He had developed a network of advisors on national security and foreign policy issues. They were very diligent and focused on making sure he was ready, that he had as broad a set of views as possible. And they really went toe-to-toe with all the people supporting me. That's not happening in this campaign. There really isn't any kind of foreign policy network that is supporting and advising Senator Sanders. I'll let him speak for himself.
All right, you get the idea. Now, Bernie Sanders, I don't have time to play the clip where he responds, but basically it's, what do you want, perpetual war? You want us to be fighting wars forever? Vote for Hillary. War forever. Which, he's got a point, I think. I don't think Hillary has much of a strategy either. Look at what happened in Libya. That's worked out fantastically for all, hasn't it? That was a Hillary move, by the way. Hillary was pushing for that big time. And she was Secretary of State when ISIS was becoming a thing. And what did she do exactly to gather a coalition to prevent ISIS from becoming a menace, not just to the region, but to the Western world? Oh, that's right. Nothing. What a surprise. But there you have it. You could expect a lot of foreign policy back and forth with these two. And I want to talk to you about what's going on with North Korea and the Super Bowl. What? More of that coming up.
Buck Sexton.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. Thank you for joining. Great to have you with me. Reuters reporting that North Korea launched a long-range rocket carrying what it called a satellite, which has drawn international condemnation just weeks after it carried out a nuclear bomb test. There are some who say this could be used as a test of technology for a long-range missile. North Korea said the launch of the satellite Kwang Myong-song 4, which was named for the late leader Kim Jong-il, was a complete success It was making a polar orbit of Earth every 94 minutes. The launch order was given by his son, Kim Jong-un. He's about 33 years old. Wow, he's like my age. And a little bit of Super Bowl trivia, courtesy of the Associated Press. North Korea's newest satellite passed almost right over the stadium just an hour after it ended. So this North Korean satellite was way up in the sky over the site of the Super Bowl, according to the Associated Press here. Well, what does this mean? What can we do about it, if anything? We're joined now by Stephen Bucci. He's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation and former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. Stephen, thank you very much for calling in.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
So let's talk about this North Korean situation first. Then there's a couple of other areas of national security I wanted to touch on with you. This seems to be a pattern. It keeps playing out. North Korea has all these sanctions against it. It is very isolated from the international community. We more or less, at least under this administration, seem to rely on China to try to rein them in. China doesn't really do a great job of doing that. And so these provocations are met with, well, what exactly? What will this lead to?
Well, to be honest with you, there's not a heck of a lot we can do to them unless we're willing to go over there and strike them. The international community, i.e. the UN in this case, you know, they called the National Security Council meeting yesterday to say, oh, gosh, we've got to do something. But as you say, heavy sanctions on them already. We probably could do more, but without Chinese assistance of a more strenuous level, there's not a lot we're going to be able to do to them.
And what is the purpose of this then? Is this just for domestic political consumption in the sense that it's, oh, look at the, this is for the greater glory of North Korea, at least the party officials and such over there who run things? It's obviously not a country where the people really get a say in anything, but this makes them feel like they're big and strong and proud? Or is this also to try to squeeze more concessions out of the international community? And what purpose does it, or is it because they want the missile technology because they want to hit us at some point? And where do you fall on the scale?
Well, I get very concerned because I don't think you can just pass off the fact that they want the technology for themselves and to sell it to others, like Iran, who is behind them in ballistic missile technology. But, you know, this, you can't just dismiss that possibility. However, a lot of it is sort of the equivalent of very, very dangerous, petulant child foot stomping, saying, hey, pay attention to us. We're still important. You can't just ignore us, because they do want those the sanctions relief. They do want concessions, because otherwise they don't have anything with which to fuel these schemes.
Now, is there a possibility, you think, of putting an advanced missile defense system in South Korea? And is that something that North Korea would react to even more provocatively? Do you think that that's the right move? What would you recommend in this circumstance?
Oh, I think we should absolutely put our missile defense system in South Korea. We can also use our shipborne missile defense capabilities and move them around. That gives us a little more flexibility. The problem we're running into there is, like when we put missile defense stuff, or we're considering to put missile defense in Europe to counter Iran, the Russians responded to it because it would also have an effect on them. In this case, if we put missile defense systems in South Korea, the Chinese get all upset about it. So, you know, you've got an administration who doesn't really like ruffling feathers, who's going to be in that possibility if they take that route. But it's probably the right way to go.
Well, one of the big concerns, I think you touched on this just a minute ago, about North Korean missile technology, nuclear technology, is that it is proliferation, right? It's the idea that this is a rogue state. They don't care who they sell this to. In fact, if they can help make the world burn down faster, they'll probably think that's a good thing. And with Iran now more open to the world, with more commerce on the way to Iran, with the sort of loosening of sanctions that's occurring, does it mean that it's going to be even harder, if not impossible, to prevent some level of proliferation in the future between North Korea and Iran on the missile technology side?
I think, given the circumstances right now with the New Deal, it would be pretty much impossible for us to say with 100% certainty that we could stop it. We still have the sanctions on North Korea, so, you know, we're blocking that end of it. You know, anything that comes out of there, we follow and try and track down. But with the openness for Iran and the willingness of other countries to work with them, you know, it might not be a one step from North Korea right to the mullahs in Tehran, but if there might be a couple of hops in between, that technology could get to Iran, and that's going to be very problematic for us, for Israel, and for our other allies in the region.
Now, trying to be as fair-minded as one can about this, has the Obama administration failed with regard to North Korea policy, or taking us sort of back to the beginning of our discussion, are there just really no good options in dealing with North Korea right now, and they've got other priorities?
Well, it's a little of both. It is difficult to deal with North Korea because most of the options have been dried up already. But the deals that we've cut with Iran and others have made America's reputation weaker, and that emboldens regimes like Kim Jong-un in North Korea to take these steps because he doesn't worry about it. The same way Russia and China are looking at us and going, the Americans are not going to do anything about this. Why should we get concerned? That reputational role is very important, and this administration is weak on it.
So you think that there is place to criticize the administration here on this, despite the fact that it's obviously a very intractable problem. There's another issue I wanted to ask you about, and I know you've written about it here on the Daily Signal. Zika virus is serious, but it's not another Ebola. I had a friend of the show who's a PhD calling last week and a microbiologist to talk a little bit about this. What do you think are the security implications for us of this Zika virus and what the Obama administration is doing to combat it?
Well, it's a very serious disease. It doesn't have the possibility really of spreading in the horrific way that Ebola can. Because, frankly, most of the people who get Zika they get sick for a couple of days and then they're okay. Now, the horrific part about it is it affects the most vulnerable, members of our society, the unborn. If a pregnant woman gets it, it can cause birth defects. So it's kind of scary from that regard. The problem now is we're really, they're still in the discovery part of this as to the transmission. It generally goes through mosquitoes, but we're finding now it can be done through sexual transmission. There's been incidents of through blood transfusion. So, the CDC is actually pretty good at this. If the politicians in the administration will let them do their thing, they'll probably handle it as well as can be expected. But I don't see it turning into the kind of scare that we had with Ebola, fortunately.
So this is something that is manageable. I always ask when people come on and talk about any of these disease issues, I've always thought that pandemic disease, when people talk about what we should be focused on as a real global threat, you've got all these climate change alarmists out there say that we're going to drown in the polar bears and there's going to be all this catastrophes as a result of global warming. But pandemic disease is a real issue, and it's one with national security implications. I think it often gets lost in the debates over these issues.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, fortunately, as I say, America has the best capabilities in the world. I mean, the World Health Organization wouldn't be worth a hoot if it wasn't supported by our CDC. But it's a very, very difficult set of problems. These things mutate, they change. It's really hard to control them. Our world is much more mobile today than ever before. So it is a set of problems that our government has to focus on. It shouldn't be all consuming. And it's not like the climate change folks who think, that's the biggest problem in the world. It's not. But disease is a serious one, and we should have the right assets aimed at it and the right resources to try and respond to them.
Now, Stephen, I just want to ask you before we go into a break here, did on the foreign policy side of things from the GOP debate, what was your biggest takeaway, or was there really a takeaway other than they all want to destroy ISIS?
First of all, we don't really talk too much about candidates or try not to, but I think, all of the Republicans are pretty strong on national defense. A little, not too many specifics, but, specifics in national defense are a tough one for candidates because it's kind of wonky and people get lost on it. I'm heartened that they all realize it's, as opposed to some of the other folks running, it isn't about climate change and jobs. It's actually about protecting the American people and our national interests. So in that regard, I think they're all, you know, they're all pointed in the right direction. Whether the specifics, when they start to come out, we'll wait and evaluate those.
All right. Stephen Bucci, visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. Thank you very much for calling in. We appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, team. We're going to go into a break here in a minute. But first, I want to tell you about something. You ever wanted to generate your own off-the-grid supply of electricity? It's just a good idea for a whole bunch of reasons. President Obama has an anti-coal, anti-electricity, anti-electricity policy, and those are pushing electrical rates to all-time highs. But more than that, there's a big threat to America's vulnerable power grid. There's never been a better time than now to protect your family with a solar generator backup system. This will be there for you in the event of any kind of emergency to your power. This new off-the-grid backup technology provides life-saving electrical power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly. It emits no fumes and produces an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. It's like having an electric power plant running silently in your own home. You can run sump pumps, shortwave radios, computers, even keep food from spoiling in your fridge. Wouldn't that be nice? Whether it's dangerous weather, brownouts, or blackouts, you'll never have to suffer through a painful power outage again. So go to BuckSolarBackup.com to learn more. Again, that is BuckSolarBackup.com. Use coupon code BUCK, B-U-C-K, and get a solar generator for half off. BuckSolarBackup.com today. Go into a break. Back after.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network. This is the Buck Sexton Show.
888-900-3393. That's the number for our phone lines, which are open. We got space. Team, I'd like to hear from you. Please do give a call. We have, we've got some lines lining up now. Also, teambuck@theblaze.com. If you want to email us, you want to communicate, want to get right through into the Freedom Hut, teambuck@theblaze.com. Or you can message me at facebook.com/BuckSexton. Any of those are excellent ways for us all to get in touch, chat, tell me what you think about the show, what we should be talking about this week. Like I said, I'll accept things written in iambic pentameter or not. Either or. It's all good. Let's take...
Who do we have here?
Jacob in Alabama. Jacob, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Buck. I was listening to you on the internet here talking about the Heritage Foundation with the Zika virus. That was really interesting news about what's happening here in the United States with the Zika virus. I wasn't sure if you were aware of the website that tracks that Zika virus here in the United States. I get a lot of my news from them. It's the ZikaVirusMap.net. Have you checked that website out?
I'm not familiar with it. I don't know if it's. I don't know who's populating it, but I'll take a look.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. I read about there was 12 cases of Zika in Florida. I have a lot of family in Florida, so that's concerning. I guess it's four counties now that have just declared disaster areas, or like declared emergencies. That's kind of like, I don't know, they do that to get federal money for the disaster area, or why would they, because Florida and now Puerto Rico declared emergency areas. I don't.
Are you asking me a question, or are you? I'm not clear on where we're going here, buddy. I'm not sure how many counties.
I thought that was really interesting that they declare emergency areas because Florida and Puerto Rico would do that. Just that I haven't heard any. It hasn't been that a long time since Florida has declared like emergency. The last time was like a hurricane. I guess it's a real serious thing with the Zika virus, I guess.
Yes, it is serious. That's why we're talking about it. So we're keeping an eye on it, and if anything comes up, we'll be sure to bring you up to speed here on the show. And Jacob from Alabama, thank you very much for calling in. Well, pandemic disease, I mentioned this before, and it's one of those areas where I always feel like when people want to talk about climate change and they're holding these climate change summits and they just all want to pat themselves on the back for being so humane and forward-leaning and thoughtful and wonderful because they're dealing with this climate change stuff. I always want to just sort of scream at the top of my lungs. You guys realize that there are people all over the world, for example, dying from malaria still. You realize that there's preventable disease out there that's killing millions of people.
year in and year out, and people are dying from these diseases. And instead of having international efforts, for example, to wipe out malaria, that's not where the focus goes. See, what I'm trying to say here is that there are limited resources, right? There's limited attention. There's limited international community action out there for things, for countries coming together and doing things, real initiatives to do things to try to make a difference when it comes to human beings, their lives, and health. And I actually haven't seen it yet. I believe it was a Vice documentary, and one of my brothers mentioned to me over the weekend, that gives some credit to the Bush administration for its very vigorous campaign against AIDS in Africa, something you won't often hear about. Every other administration, including this one, has paled in comparison to the efforts that the Bush administration made to really combat AIDS in Africa, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. And efforts like that are, you know, you look at that, there's dollars going into this, and there are people who are living and people who are not suffering horrifically from disease, in this case HIV, because of those efforts. That, to me, is important and worthy and worthwhile, and there's return on investment as a human being from that, right? And I just get so angry when people want to talk about what the climate's going to be in 50 years when we have all of these diseases that are out there right now, some of which we could take really dramatic action against. I mean, malaria is a very good example. Malaria used to be in the United States. I mean, you go back and read about what it was like for the founders. You know, D.C. was like an infested malarial swamp. I think they also had yellow fever and or typhus, I mean, all kinds of horrible stuff. I mean, people hated it. One of the reasons why they'd empty it out in the summer, people hated being in D.C. in the summer months. A lot of them still do. It's really kind of gross there sometimes in the summer. But people absolutely hated it. You know, they had this real fear of disease down there because there were these diseases in the United States. They were eradicated over time. We could eradicate, and other countries with our help could eradicate disease that affects people. You know, malaria is something you have. It can come back. There are relapses. It can kill you, obviously, but also even if it doesn't kill you, the parasite can stay in your system and you can have relapses later on. It's terrible. And, you know, there's all these people that want to pat themselves on the back for their international action against climate change, and it's not that that stuff comes without a cost is what I'm trying to get at here. It's not that that means that, oh, we can do everything at the same time. No, that's money, that's time, that's effort that would be much better spent dealing with a real problem, and people are suffering, but it's just so much more, you know, it's so much more self-gratifying to tackle a problem that is 50 years out and really just means you're going to be going to a lot of fancy dinners and charity events where you talk about it and feel good about yourself instead of actually having to roll up your sleeves and deal with the problem where you can see if there are results. You can see if your campaign against malaria, or in this case against Zika, which is what got me thinking about this, if you can have real results, if what you're doing is working or not. That's the great part about climate change stuff is, you know, does it work? Does it not work? Whatever. Let's have another big summit somewhere fancy where we can ski when we're not meeting to talk about how we're saving the world. It's just all really really bothersome to me because they could be doing good with that time and with that money, and they're wasting the goodwill of many other people who just don't know any better. All right, on the flip side of this, we have to talk about this commercial, this Doritos commercial. Much more coming up. I'll be right back.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Listening to the Buck Sexton Show.
So, team, I watched the Super Bowl, as I'm sure many of you did. I watched it last night with my brothers and my dad, man time. And we watched the Super Bowl, and it was, a pretty boring game, I thought, all things considered. I know, but I'm happy for Peyton Manning. And I agree. It was kind of a boring game. It was very, it was a defensive exhibition. Great. I would have rather seen some, 40-yard passes for touchdowns. But anyway, that's just me. So it was fine, and I'm certainly not a football analyst. I'm not going to waste your time by giving you my sense of football, right? Because there are a lot of people, I'm the first to admit, a lot of people you should listen to instead of me on football. But commercials that played last night were generally unfunny. were not good. And this is something, right, this is supposed to be part of the whole, part of the entertainment, is you watch these commercials and they're supposed to be very clever and memorable. And I think they cost, what, $4 million each or something was what I heard, or $3 million each, or some huge price tag attached to these commercials. And there was one commercial that seemed kind of funny, and it was for Doritos. And it showed a woman who's having an ultrasound done. You can see her baby, and her husband's there, and she's got the ultrasound tech, and the husband's eating some Doritos, and the baby clearly really likes them, even though his baby's still inside the womb, and the baby's hand sort of moves. We'll play the audio. I wish I could play the video. We didn't get to it before, but play the audio.
And there's your beautiful baby.
Any day now.
Really? You're eating Doritos? He's eating Doritos on my ultrasound. Do you see what I have to do?
I know.
Give me that.
So they throw a Dorito across the room, and the baby kind of like jumps out. Like, you know, you get the sense of it. They don't show this, but the baby is supposed to sort of like go, you know, running across the room after it or something. So, look, if you watch the commercial, it was meant to be funny. It was funny. And I think everyone sort of just took it in that way. And it was one of the only memorable commercials. I mean, so many of the commercials were terrible. I was like, what is this? It's garbage. But Nayrol, which, you know, Nayrol and what is it? Nayrol and Pro-Choice America, whatever. Nayrol, which is this pro-abortion group. Nayrol decided that they were going to tweet out from their official account this. Hashtag not buying it. That Doritos ad using anti-choice tactic of humanizing fetuses and sexist tropes of dads as clueless and moms as uptight. Okay, well, it should go without saying that Nayrol probably has no sense of humor about anything, period. But this goes beyond not having a sense of humor. Anti-choice tactic of humanizing fetuses. What do they think a fetus is? This would be sort of a fascinating discussion to have, I think, with some of these people. What do they really believe is in there? They think that this is what exactly? It's some sort of a growth? It's like, is it a benign tumor? What do they think is growing in the womb? This little object that has fingers and a brain and eyes and a heart. And what do they think this is? This is one of the more frightening propaganda situations, one of the more frightening lies that's told to us by the media over and over again, that there can be people out there who want, look, if you're going to take the position, as many in the pro-choice movement do, that it's a tiny baby, but you as a woman have the right to kill a tiny baby because you don't want to have it, that's, I think, grossly immoral, but at least it's an intellectually consistent position in the sense that you know what you're doing, right? What Nayrol and some of these other groups seem to think they can get away with is, no, it's not, a fetus is not a baby, this isn't a person, this is some other, as yet undescribed, scientific entity. You know, it's not a human being, it's something else. Well, what is it? Well, it's a fetus. Well, isn't a fetus just a human being in one stage of development? That's like saying it's not a person, it's an old person. Well, no, very old people, you know, they're human beings. We you know, just because you're 100 doesn't mean that people don't, you don't have rights and you know, you're an old person. Oh, no, it's different. You're in a different stage of your life. And it, obviously, as you know, the Margaret Sanger and the founders of this pro-choice movement, these are people, the founder of Planned Parenthood. These are people who actually also always have a taste for eugenics as well, unsurprisingly. They just don't have this belief that there's anything special particularly about life, and that, you know, things like convenience and you know, political movements are more important. And many of us, I think, who see this and realize that there's not the political power to stop these things right now, or that it's not going to happen, just look at this on the one hand in sort of shock and revulsion, but also with a sense of shame that we're in a society that allows this kind of thing to happen around us, and also a deep sadness for the people who, I think in some cases, just know not what they do. They don't really understand the full implications of not just, and I'm not talking, by the way, about somebody who makes the choice for herself personally. That's even a separate part of this discussion. I mean those who advocate these policies on an industrial, a massive scale, and will defend them and will lie about them and will do anything in order to protect this abortion industry, and that we can't even watch the Super Bowl and have a moment of levity that by no means, by the way, this was not some clever tactic to humanize the fetus. People I already know, and you either live in the real world, the scientific world, you could even say, where a fetus is a human being inside a womb, or you can create this other this other parallel universe where it just is something else. You don't have to describe what it is, but don't worry about it. It's not your problem. It's something else. So NARAL got a fair amount of heat, I think, on this, as it well should have. And it wasn't the only, in the last few days, by the way, it wasn't the only instance where you started to sort of see, or you got a chance to see, just how extreme the abortion lobby is in this country, and also how powerful it is. It's a very, very powerful entity in politics, and you can go through the why on this, and that's maybe something that we don't do enough of on the conservative side of things on the right. Christians that believe that there's actually morality. I really think that the Christian sects, and I'm not somebody who ever sits around and plays the who's more religious than somebody else game, and you know, I'm very personal about what I believe and don't believe, and I would never seek to lecture anybody in any of that stuff, and nor could I with tremendous background and eloquence, I wouldn't pretend to. You know, you start quoting Bible verses, I'm better than 2 Corinthians Trump, but I'm just saying this is not usually a place where I go often, but I see with some of these Christian denominations, there are the ones that seem to believe in rules and the ones that don't. You know, they're the ones that seem to think that you've got to be moral and follow the example of Christ, and they're the ones that are kind of like, yeah, it's really just sort of music and hanging out on Sunday. Okay. People are allowed to do what they want, but I do feel like there's a pretty clear delineation between, and on issues of life, this is where you really see it. Right, this is where you see if the seriousness of a Christian tradition, to be sure, and this is something that I think doesn't get very much attention right now. It's sort of slipping under the radar, and I actually applaud some of the Republican candidates. Marco Rubio deserves credit for this, for pointing out just how extreme the abortion lobby is, and how Democrat politicians are allowed to be pro-abortion from the moment of conception all the way up until the moment of birth. And that's considered normal and that's considered okay. That this doesn't give us sort of shudder of barbarism, or doesn't give us all sort of a shudder of just shock at the barbarism that this really entails. And that churches don't speak out on this issue. And that the Catholic Church doesn't really speak out on this issue. Maybe the Catholic Church feels like it's just too embattled in this country as it is, but some of the more prominent politicians I can think of, I often mention Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden. These are people who don't just, this isn't just somebody who would advocate for their own, say, family member, you know, child, grandchild, whatever, to have an abortion either now or at some point in the future if they so chose. I mean, this isn't even just a matter of their personal choices in their lives. This is a matter of the policies they advocate and making sure that government funding goes to this, the taxpayer dollars goes to this. And yet, churches say nothing. In this case, the Catholic Church, there could be others as well. They say nothing. They just let this go on. They don't deny communion to these politicians, which they very much should do. Either there's meaning to all this or there's not. And I have to say that these days it feels more and more like there's just this sort of accepted silence from so many on this issue, people who could make a difference and who could say something that would have meaning when it comes to life. So NARAL, the bottom line here is NARAL is obviously crazy and deranged, and this should be apparent to any normal thinking person, right? This is not having a discussion. This is not a debate in the areas where, you know, it gets a little trickier. This is not, oh, well, what about rape or incest? Or, oh, and which, for example, Marco Rubio stands very strong on that issue, doesn't care, says it's a life. A life is a life. No, this is, NARAL is, you know, the more, when it comes to abortions, the more the merrier. It's great. It's something to be celebrated. I mean, these groups are deeply twisted. And this then brings me to a piece that hasn't gotten very much attention at all. And I think is should send a chill wind across the entire country as to just how powerful the abortionists and the abortion the pro-abortion media is. And that's that. And I'll be honest with you, there are very few things that I feel like if I went on certain TV channels and talked about, I would be, there would be retribution. I really believe there'd be retribution. People, you know, will threaten you when you're someone like me and you go on TV, and I never, you know, whatever, bring a jihadist. Like, I'm not worried about that. But that you would feel retribution in some way against your career, against you later. Abortion is definitely one of them. I think it's top of the list. I think if you go on TV and you advocate a pro-life stance, they'll come and you're like on a list. They're going to come and get you later. It's just the way it is. Maybe not physically, but career-wise, professionally, you are in trouble. A federal judge, this was from the New York Times, ordered the Center for Medical Progress on Friday. This just happened on Friday. It ordered an injunction against the Center for Medical Progress releasing the videos that it had made of Planned Parenthood and what was going on at these abortion providers. Think about that. This is undercover journalism that's being suppressed by a federal judge. What, the public doesn't have a right to? There's no public right to know here. There's no public interest in this. I'll get into the details of this more in a moment, but this is appalling stuff. Appalling stuff indeed. I'll be back after the break.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.
So in this ruling from a federal judge on Friday, there's an injunction against the Center for Medical Progress releasing any more videos that they have made at abortion providers. And this judge said that the opponents' claims that organizations were illegally selling fetal tissue were baseless. Well, they were selling fetal tissue for sure. But illegally selling, that's where it gets very Clintonian, right? Because they can't make a profit. They can only take back their cost in procurement. Well, what is the difference? You know, if I am going to go out and, you know, weed your front lawn, and I'm telling you that it causes some cost for me, I have to go buy some supplies and such, and I say, well, you know, it's gonna, my labor is $500, you need to reimburse me $500 for that job, that would be very expensive, but you know what I mean. Am I making a profit? Seems like it. I get to set the price. These providers certainly got to set their own price, and it's a big business for them. But people are so invested in this, the ideology blinds them, and this federal judge is clearly in that camp. Judge William Orrick is, I'm sure, an Obama appointee. He also said he brushed aside claims by the abortion opponents from the New York Times that their use of fraudulent documents and violations of confidentiality agreements to infiltrate meetings of abortion providers were protected because they were journalists involved in what they describe as an undercover investigation. By the way the Times write this, it's all, the whole thing is meant to sort of undermine the Center for Medical Progress all the time. There's no, you never get the sense that the New York Times, even for one instance, is trying to defend the First Amendment, feels like these are fellow journalists, feels like there's something to this. No, this is the sacrament of the Democratic Party. This is the most sacred right that they have, right, R-I-T-E. This is what they do. And the New York Times is neck deep in supporting this, promoting this, making sure that this is a reality in this country. And this is what we can expect, I suppose, from the federal judges who have been, the courts have been packed with Obama appointees. One of the more lasting legacies, negative legacies of this administration, and there are so many to choose from, is the court packing that Obama has engaged in. Remember when they got rid of the whole, they changed the rules about federal judges? Yeah, that's right. All of a sudden you couldn't filibuster. They changed the rules in the Senate when Obama had a majority in the Senate. Guess what they did? Ran through as many far left judges as they could. And in very important circuit courts as well. And now you see this here. There, not only are we being told that there should be no journalistic, no First Amendment protections afforded for the Center for Medical Progress at all, but also it's this judge is saying it's baseless that these Planned Parenthood organizations were selling fetal tissue. It's a lie. This judge is a liar. And this judge is complicit in the trafficking of murdered baby parts by suppressing the truth about this and by punishing, actively punishing, trying to punish, at least, the journalists from the Centers for Medical Progress. This is an utter and complete disgrace. And it's a reminder to all of us that if you think that you'll get justice if you go in front of a federal court, think again. Just remember that in many cases, places like New York, San Francisco, and elsewhere, you're going to go in front of a judge that was handpicked by the Obama administration, my friends. You think you're going to get a fair trial if there's any politics at all involved in this? You think that judge is going to be on your side if you stand in the way of the abortion lobby, the abortion industry? I don't think so. More coming up in Hour 3. We'll change up topics.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to Hour 3 in the Freedom Hut today. Thank you so much for being here. 888-900-3393. I'd like to take your calls. Chat about whatever you like today. Obviously, tomorrow is going to be a big day in the GOP and Democrat races with New Hampshire primary going down. We'll be talking about that a lot tomorrow, so I won't give you too much more of that today. I actually wanted to switch gears a little bit and look at a piece written in the Washington Post. Let's talk immigration. I like to talk to you about immigration. It says, as immigration resurges, U.S. public schools help children find their footing. Now, this is obviously a very... The Washington Post, it's owned by Jeff Bezos now, it's very pro-immigration, essentially saying that the public school system is providing sanctuary in more ways than one for the influx of children from the third world and from war-torn countries, from poor countries, and how they're now arriving in schools in large numbers and have been for a long time. This is not new. But given the debates going on right now within the GOP and within the DNC, within the Democrat and Republican sides of this, looking at what it's actually like in these schools right now is probably a worthwhile exercise. Now, of course, from the Washington Post here, you're getting as favorable a view of this as one can when you're talking about large numbers of students arriving in the public school system, which, of course, is funded with your taxpayer dollars, who are teenagers, maybe they're 15, 16, 17, don't speak English, are way behind academically. And as this piece writes, they often come with scars, having fled desperate poverty or violence or both. Many endured difficult journeys, sometimes leaving their families behind or rejoining parents in the United States after years of separation. And U.S. schools, already strapped for resources, are trying to provide special services, including English language instruction and mental health care. So your tax dollars, let's just speak frankly about this. Your tax dollars are going towards instructing immigrants, in many cases illegal immigrants, because illegal immigrant children in the United States are entitled to an education, even if they aren't allowed to be here. Regardless of their immigration status, the law says that children in this country have a right to public education. So your tax dollars are now going towards English language instruction in schools, to additional mental health counseling, not for the sorts of problems one would expect in the United States, but more along the lines of what you'd expect from a country that is in the midst of a civil war or widespread violence, gang violence. And these are where resources now are having to be spent. Now, we're often told that the public school system in this country is failing overall, that the Department of Education just, well, the left says it just needs more money. The rest of us, many of us on the right, say it should be abolished, that it's that education should be a function of the states, that the federal government should not be in the education game, period, anyway. But what we see here, once again, is that this does become, this takes us back to what immigration turns into, which is a scheme for the redistribution of wealth. Right. You can't tell me that bringing in many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of non-English speaking, uneducated, or what's perhaps a better word than uneducated? There's some level of education, undereducated, let's say, non-English speaking immigrants is going to make the school system better. I mean, do you think that your child now, if your child's in public school in a place where there's a large population of illegal immigrants, do you think that your child now gets more individualized instruction, gets more attention from teachers, or less? Does this slow these classes down? Does this make it harder for them to move along at a pace that would allow them to meet bare minimum standards for the state for proficiency in math, proficiency in reading? And when you start to look at the actual testing scores of different states and how students are doing, how many students, for example, get to be 18 years old and really can't read or write, it's pretty appalling. And yet, here we are with even larger numbers of students who are entering into this system who are very unlikely indeed to be additive in a classroom setting. And now I know this starts to sound, it's harsh, but it's true, right? Well, how do we avoid this conversation? I mean, this piece is saying that there were more than 630,000 immigrant students nationwide in the 2013-2014 school year. And that defines immigrants as children born outside the country and enrolled in U.S. schools for less than 3 years. And that figure has grown. So you're talking about a huge number of immigrant children in U.S. schools, huge number across the country. And some schools are flooded with students who are foreign and who are immigrants. For example, they mention here High Point, which they say, like many other schools flooded with foreign students, has had to adjust. A school with an enrollment of 2,400, it has registered 282 new immigrants so far this school year alone. Last year, it took on 396 new immigrants. The year before, 307. Some of them immigrated legally, others did not. Many arrived from December to March because the Central American school year ends in December. And they said this is becoming normal for us. We planned for the influx from the beginning of the year. So a lot of these are Central American kids who are getting here. Remember, the rule is if you're Central American, you say that you're fleeing violence and you're claiming asylum and you're under 18, you get to stay. So now we're seeing these tens of thousands of kids who are jumping ahead of the rest of people who are trying to come here legally, who are not bringing any special skills. In fact, they're bringing a lot of illiteracy and often social and psychological baggage with them. So this is what's happening now in these schools. This is what the Washington Post says. Not everyone believes the nation's tax dollars should be used to educate immigrants who arrive in the country illegally, and others argue that forcing school districts to take on the challenge isn't fair when resources are already stretched too thin. Congress should not allow the Obama administration to incentivize illegal immigration and human smuggling by rewarding those who participate, Jessica Vaughn of the Center for Immigration Studies told the House Judiciary Subcommittee Thursday, arguing that youths and other immigrants should be detained near the border. She said the cost of meeting the educational needs for the kids who arrive illegally as part of the surge is the main way the administration's policy is burdensome to state and local governments. It's a huge problem with very real costs in a number of ways. Costs in the sense of tax dollars spent on this, but also what is one to think, especially if a school district is where a large number of these Central American immigrant youths are being relocated. The school is going to be better now? You think the testing scores are going to go up? You want to send your kid to that school? Oh, if you pull your kid out, you're racist. Or you're xenophobic. You don't like immigrants. But when people are making decisions about their children, they often tend to stop caring what's said about them. They just care about their kids. One of the best examples of this was the row, maybe it was a year ago now, over there are two high schools in Dumbo, which is a very, very sort of hip and high end part of Brooklyn where cool, very left wing people live. And the two schools, one school was doing very well and was predominantly full of, it was majority white students. And the other school was doing terribly. It was majority black students. And sure enough, some of the progressives on the school board said, you know, what we really need to do here is just mix and match and just
separate out these schools so that we have greater diversity. We want diverse student bodies, so we're going to send a lot more of the white kids to the predominantly black school and a lot more of the black kids to the predominantly white school, and that will fix the problem. And these progressive left-wing parents lost their minds over this. They freaked out. All of a sudden, they didn't care how obvious their hypocrisy was. You see, they'll go on TV and they'll applaud Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes and these MSNBC talking heads. And they'll applaud anybody who goes on television or goes in media and talks about how, you know, how dare you get upset that there are more and more immigrant children enrolled in school with your kid. And when I say children, we're talking about often teenagers, people who don't speak English, who are oftentimes traumatized, are going to be disproportionately completely reliant, or their families are reliant on welfare. And I don't know. I mean, some will be patriotic, I suppose, and love America. Plenty won't. Plenty will resent this place. They'll be told to resent this place by the ethnic front groups that exist specifically to perpetuate and fan those flames of resentment. That America owes them more, that America hasn't done enough, that America's racist, that America's oppressive, it's imperialist. All these Yankee imperialists in America, they're the reason Central America's so poor and desperate. They're the reason that Latin America, by and large, has not had the sort of economic growth of the last 100 years that it obviously should have. It's all Americans' fault. So they owe you more, don't you see? It's not your fault. It's their fault. And they're lucky you're here, because diversity is our strength. And you can just see how all the rhetoric gets packed in together. But that's because it's your kids. It's not their kids. They'll find a way to make sure that their kids don't go to a school that is full of non-English speaking immigrants from many different places all over the world, by the way. Not even just Central America, they're from all over the place. And you can say, well, you know, don't those kids deserve an education too? Yeah, okay, but is that going to make the school better? Are you allowed to make choices about what school you go to now? Can we have a school for English speakers and a school for non-English speakers? Well, they would never allow that. Because obviously the English speaker school would be a better school if you're getting English language instruction, which you're going to get. So this is what they offer you. This is what the left really boils down to. They pretend to care so much about education, and they pretend that this is all about doing what's right. Meanwhile, for their kids, for their students, they want to make sure that they go to the best school possible. They get the best education possible. But if that means condemning your kids to go to a place where there are students who are having nightmares about the time MS-13 gunned down people in the street in front of their home and don't speak any English and have basically no education to speak of, at least by American standards, if they have to share a classroom with those kids and that slows them down and resources have to be spent trying to explain everything to them in their native language, whatever it may be, Spanish or otherwise, there's many languages spoken in the public school system now, that's your problem. And this is, education is where the hypocrisy of the left is on, one of the places where it's on most obvious display. I still remember early on in the Obama administration, he ended up reversing himself on this. But because, you know, teachers unions own the Democratic Party, he was opposed to charter schools in D.C. initially and there was some issue with charter school funding in D.C. Meanwhile, Obama's kids are going to, what was it, Sidwell Friends, one of the fancy private schools. And it's probably $30,000 a year. But that's for his kids. Now, they get to go to a fancy private school. Your kids don't even get the chance to go to a charter school. That's the way it works. And you see this playing out across the country. And this is on the issue of the redistribution of wealth and how immigration does that. Education is a good and service, right? Education is a thing. It is hours in the classroom. It is instructors who have to get trained, instructors who have to give their time. It is textbooks. It is material. It is access to computers. It is, you know, uniforms and sports teams and all of that. And if that process is overwhelmed by students with the particular needs of those who come, in many cases, illegally into the country, and therefore their families are here illegally, and, you know, they're not exactly going to be wedded to the social fabric of America right away because they're so-called living in the shadows. But this is not a problem for the Democrat elites, and it's certainly not a problem for minority groups that seem to think that, although it is interesting, we'll see how this plays out between the Latino community and the African-American community coming up in this election, because
the African-American community is, I think, increasingly aware, or you're noticing more articles at least written about this, that new immigrants compete for jobs with them. And that unskilled labor depresses the wages of native-born Americans, including Black Americans, who otherwise could be moving their way up into the middle class through these professions. So there are winners and losers in this whole process. And while it might feel nice and good for people who read the Washington Post, who live in fancy suburbs of D.C. or who live in on the Upper West Side of New York or in Santa Monica or wherever, they read about this stuff and they think, oh, great. Well, I'm so glad that we're spending all this time and all these resources trying to educate the children of the third world. There are a lot of Americans who are already here, including legal immigrants who have been here for a generation or two, who are saying, you know, this really stinks. This slows down the classroom. This makes the schools less effective. This is a huge drain on resources, and my tax dollars are going to prop this whole thing up, and I have no choice in the matter. I don't like this. This is where part of the anger at our immigration system comes from. You're not getting a fair deal, and you have no say in it. 888-900-3393. We'll take a break here. Back right after.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
Let's take a call from Tim in Phoenix. Tim, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome.
Shields high, sir.
Shields high, Tim. What's going on?
I just wanted to talk about your previous conversation on the education system and immigration. There is a big-time hit in the English-speaking aspect, or English as a second language, just as you described before. And it's just completely unfair to the English speakers that are being taken down like an anchor because they're not getting the resources. I totally believe in the voucher system. Would love to see something similar to that be implemented.
Well, it just seems inexcusable to me that there are schools now that they have to constantly bring in like translators and do all this work. You know, they have limited resources as it is. You should be able to say, you know what, I want to send my kid to a school where it's just in English. Everything is in English. We don't worry about other. You can set up some other school for people that get to learn in different languages. This is the school where we just learn in the language that people speak in America, which is English, which should be, by the way, the official language of this country, and it is not, which is a shame. But anyway,
we don't see any signs that say alto on the freeway or instead of stop signs, it says alto. But I live in South Phoenix, which is a pretty heavily, not dominant, but a huge immigrant location. And there are dozens and dozens, probably half of the billboards that you see in the area are all in Spanish. Everything from McDonald's to gas to church.
Yeah, look, there are parts of L.A. that I wonder how different it is if you were to go into, you know, the other side of the border in terms of the prevalence of Spanish language, you know, signs and everything else. I mean, this is true in different parts of California. I know it's true in some parts of Texas. And, you know, Tim, it's the educational aspect of this, though, is I think where it really hits home for a lot of people, because one, in some districts, your property taxes, a huge portion of them are going towards the school system. It's crazy.
With one final thought there for you to break into whatever you're in next.
Yes.
Just lost my train of thought. Obama administration and the left in general has taken over the healthcare system. And of course, their next logical step is to take over education. When they do that, there's going to be a huge hit to the left. I mean, the pendulum is already pegged to the left. We definitely need the pendulum to come back to the right, or at least somewhat center right, like the rest of the country. But taking over the education system like they did with Medicaid and Obamacare is just devastating to this country, both financially and principle-wise.
All right. Tim from Phoenix, we're out of time. Thank you for calling in, my friend. Yeah, education, always known, as I've said to you before, Muslim Brotherhood, whenever they can choose them, you know, whenever they can, the ministry they always want to take control of. This was true in Jordan. Whenever they sort of say, okay, we'll calm down. We won't cause as much agitation. You know, Islamist parties, they always want education. If you can control the youth, you can control what they think, you can indoctrinate them, well, then you can get the politics you want. You're just a generation or two away. And how do you think that's going for us these days in public school, by the way? You think there's a lot of free market, individual freedom instruction going on in our public schools? Well, maybe there is, but these days might not be in English. More coming up after the break.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. One of the things that constantly annoys me is that there's nothing that's beyond the reach of politicization and politics anymore, right? It's just always shoved in our faces. And with pop culture, you know, can't we just have a sort of unwritten understanding in this country that, you know, everyone needs the ability to just de-stress, to think about other things, to get swept up in a good story, to escape from their day-to-day problems and stresses and issues through the medium of entertainment, right? Through being entertained. I think this is something that should bring us all together all the time. This is not controversial stuff. This is really obvious stuff. And yet you can't even watch a Super Bowl, it seems, without there being some sort of a political message. Not a wardrobe malfunction in this case, but a wardrobe choice that's supposed to make us think of certain things. This is a hat tip Billy Halliwell, my Blaze colleague on TheBlaze.com. Beyonce is capturing attention for controversial political messages that were embedded in her Super Bowl 50 halftime show on Sunday night, with critics and fans debating over whether her dancers presumably being dressed or whether her dancers presumably being dressed like Black Panthers and making a Black Power salute. Performing her new song Formation, Beyonce and her dancers were dressed in all black, wore black berets, and at one point positioned themselves in an X on the field, something that some observers said was done in reference to Malcolm X. And then you have Beyonce, some tweets that the Daily Mail reported on. Beyonce's dancers in black berets at Super Bowl 50, paying homage to Black Panthers 50 years after their formation in 66. And one of the dancers was seen after the performance supposedly making a Black Power salute while holding a sign that read, "Justice for Mario Woods." Well, for one thing, you're going to get a lot of attention if you have Coldplay as the opening act, which is like, for me now, Coldplay is the new Kenny G. Yeah, I said it. That's right. And it's just so boring. They're playing a song from like 7 years ago to start off with, and this is the best we can do. And then you get Beyonce and Bruno Mars coming out here. But it just seems to me like this is so symptomatic of this larger problem of everything always has to have, or the left always seems to do this, right? And you could say that's because the left has a stranglehold over pop culture, which is largely true. But the politics that have to, people have to inflict this on us, I don't really understand why there's not more of a backlash against this. I really don't want to hear what semi-educated entertainers think about American politics. And I resent very much so when they seem to want to thrust it in our faces when we're not. Look, if Beyonce wants to hold a forum, or Bruno Mars or Chris, whatever his name is, from Coldplay, if they want to hold a forum entitled, you know, "Entertainers Enlighten You About Politics," and you can pay tickets and go and listen to that, that's fine. I think that the only thing you would hear would be crickets chirping, and that would be it. But that's a straightforward and honest way to do it. You know, if they want to, You know, if you've got Al Franken out there, he ran for political office. Okay, he put himself in the arena, and he somehow, and Minnesota, I'm sorry, I know there are lots of lovely people in Minnesota, but this just, what is going on there, guys? I keep saying it. And Jesse Ventura, Al Franken, I mean, really? Really? Anyway, but you can't even turn on very straightforward entertainment like the Super Bowl and watch this without having some sort of a political message thrust in your face. I'll be honest with you, I didn't really pick up on it at the time because I was kind of half watching. I do not really care about it. First of all, it was Coldplay, right? Coldplay comes out. And Ty's saying in my ear, perhaps it's not true. And maybe it is all coincidence. I don't know. You know, Daily Mail is reporting on it. We got theblaze.com here saying that this is the political statement that was embedded in the Super Bowl. I don't know. And I will say, I don't really care insofar as about what the message is. I just care more that we can never escape this stuff now. Maybe this isn't even a good example of it, but it doesn't change the overall thesis, which is that no matter where you are now, no matter what you're trying to do, if you're trying to just kick back, put your feet up, and enjoy entertainment, it's very likely that there's going to be politics thrust in your face. I mean, you know, HBO, for example, has some great shows. It's so left-wing, though. It's so left-wing. Oh, gosh. All the time, you have to just sort of accept that there's going to be some, you know, some progressive agenda item. And occasionally they're very sly about it. Sometimes it's much more straightforward, but it's going to be just jammed down your throat. You're going to have no choice but to accept it. And that's the way that it will be. So this is what's going on here. The political statement embedded in Beyonce's Super Bowl halftime performance. I don't know, guys. Seems like there's no way you can get around this stuff these days. And, you know, I watch, and I shouldn't do this myself, but I watch whenever there's one of these celebrities that goes on. You know, Bill Maher is a show that has a fair amount of celebrities on. There are other shows, too. And it's just astonishing that people who, quite honestly, don't have jobs that really require that much of them. I know actors. Oh, it's so hard. It's hard to be a successful actor, but being an actor once you're successful is not a hard job to do. Well, how would you know, Buck? Come on, guys. Okay, I mean, let's be serious for a second here. It's not brain surgery. It's not rocket surgery, as I would like to say. So yeah, it's one of these situations where I look at this and I think to myself that there's no way you can get around this. And also, by the way, I think I told you I watched Straight Outta Compton. I couldn't even get through the whole thing. Speaking of politics and culture. I watched it at a Compton. It just wasn't that good. I watched more than half of it and I was like, this is okay. I get it. Right. Like, yeah, the police are bad and I get it, you know? The other movie that was supposed to be really good that didn't get much, that didn't get any Oscar nods or whatever. I actually was just told today by one of my producers that Creed was great. So maybe Creed should have gotten, did Creed get any nominations for anything? Sylvester Stallone did, but not Michael Jordan, the young actor playing Apollo Creed's son. Okay. Ty says no black individual in that movie was nominated. I thought Michael Jordan was good back in the day. This is Michael B. Jordan to distinguish him from the famous basketball player, or Michael E. Jordan or something. I forget. But he was good in Friday Night Lights seasons 4 and 5, where he played a sort of troubled youth. But nonetheless. But Creed's apparently what's up? Ty is telling me something. No, that's all right. Sorry, you guys can't always hear it. Ty has a conversation. Ty's running the board for me. He has a conversation in my ear. The Creed movie was supposed to be pretty good. Straight Outta Compton was not very good, in my opinion. I didn't see it. But the other movie that was supposed to be great, people were upset about, was that Will Smith didn't get a nod for a movie about concussions in football. And nobody wants to watch a movie about concussions in football. That much I can tell you. I haven't seen it, but that's because I don't want to see it, because I don't really care. I think you can assume that a high contact sport like football is going to have some long-term consequences. This is just the way it is. This is just true. There are a lot of sports actually that take a tremendous toll on your body, and you know, professional athletes will often, there's a reason why they often have surgeries and have to come back from surgeries, and they're asking their bodies to do things that they're not really meant to do. Now, in the case of football and boxing, it can be kind of extreme, the punishment you put your body through, and there could be after effects, but I don't think there's anything you could show any of those players on that field yesterday at the Super Bowl. There's no long-term statistics. There's no risk profile that you could show them that would make them think that this is not what they want to do with their time, that they would rather not be there. that's just the truth. And I am not some huge proponent, as you know, of certainly not a huge proponent of college athletics under the NCAA and the way that it currently goes. I think it's bizarre that we've turned universities into minor league sports franchises in a lot of cases, but that's a separate discussion. But I also think that, you know, player safety is important, and I wouldn't want people getting, you know, severely injured on the field and such. But, you know, if you're going to play football, these sorts of things are going to happen. But a movie about concussions with Will Smith in it, no one wants to see it. So, again, you can try the political angle on things, or you can try to take a political stand with your artistic interpretations of the world around you. But sometimes it's just not gonna work very well. So I don't know. So wait, Ty, let me ask you before you go. Did you think the Beyonce thing was political? Yes or no? Ty says no. So I don't know. We should. I should have had Billy Hollowell on here. He wrote this piece. Have Billy explain to me why he thought this one was political. Although I have seen it elsewhere. Daily Mail certainly picked it up. But you know what the truth is? I think Bruno Mars, very, very talented guy, and you know, pretty amazing. I'm just, Beyonce's good, but not like, I'm just not a huge Beyonce person. I don't know. I'm just not. You know, I know that makes me a bad guy in some circles, but she's not. I don't know. She's no Whitney Houston. I'm going to say it. It's just the truth. I don't know. She's very different. Very different kind of artist. All right. We're going to talk about Hillary's emails on the flip side of this break. Don't go anywhere. Back in a few.
Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.
Dispensing the truth.
This is Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, as I've told you, teambuck@theblaze.com is our email alias. You can send any emails you want to teambuck@theblaze.com. And I've got a couple of them here I just want to share with you. We've got one from Chris. He says, as I did when I met Ted Cruz in Iowa, I'd like to apologize to the country on behalf of Minnesota. Believe it or not, there are many liberty-loving people here, but the liberal slime pit of Minneapolis-St. Paul outnumbers us. We were one of two states to go blue against Reagan. We elected Ventura, then Al Franken. It's quite honestly embarrassing for conservatives in this state. All we can do is apologize from the bottom of our hearts. We're sorry. Thanks, Chris. You know I'm just kidding when I make fun of Minnesota for this stuff, but it is pretty amazing that Minnesota has given us just, wow, Jesse Ventura and then Al Franken. Guys, what's going on? And we have another one here from David. He says, hey, Buck, I'm a big fan of the show, and I do a podcast on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And I assume he means he listens. And the one on Wednesday and Friday I do for Doc and Skip for their, I don't know what he's talking about here. I'm always trying to do better and get better and grow. And as I'm a big fan of your work, I want to know if you had any recommendations or suggestions or even any books you might recommend reading to just help get a better knowledge of politics and understanding. I know it's a broad question. I'm always trying to grow my knowledge. Thanks, David. Any books or suggestions? Oh, man. I mean, I should probably publish a list. I did put up on Facebook.com/BuckSexton a few weeks ago just a photo of the sort of pile that's next to my bed. Some of those are books I've already read. Some of them are books that I'm planning on reading soon. Right now, I'm in the middle of reading a book called Submission it's actually a novel by Michel Houellebecq. I think I'm pronouncing the last name right, although I don't know. Which is fascinating, and I will tell you about it. It's a little racy, just putting that out there, so not for the kids at all, definitely 18+, but it has very interesting themes in it, which I'll be talking about perhaps another day, but that's not a recommendation. Don't go to that right now. There are other things that I would put way ahead of that on the list. I don't know, if you're looking for stuff on conservative politics, there's so many places to go. I mean, you've got the greats, the classics. If you haven't read The Road to Serfdom, I feel like that's a must read by Hayek. If you haven't read 1984 by Orwell, it's a must read. There's so many. I should probably come up with some kind of a list. If you haven't read Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke, highly recommend that. John Stuart Mill on Liberty, that would be a high recommendation. Those are the ones that come to mind right away. All those would be things that I feel like you have to read if you have not already read. Like, skip whatever you're reading now, put it down and read one of those.
That would be my recommendation. On Liberty's a little bit like you're in a political science class, but Road to Serfdom is great and very, very much well worth the read. 1984 is amazing. I've read it more than once. I recommend you do the same. All right, I told you that we would just do a little bit of an update here on the Clinton email situation, which the latest on this is that there's some pressure on Loretta Lynch to maybe step aside in the Clinton email probe. You see, this is how I've always known that Hillary Clinton will not be charged. This is how I've always known that Hillary Clinton is going to skate on this whole email issue. She knows that there are some fail-safes in place. And the most important fail-safe is that you have, at the top of the Justice Department right now, Loretta Lynch, an Obama appointee, a progressive, who is not going to allow criminal charges or even embarrassing revelations, really, to come out against the first would-be female president of the United States from the Democratic Party. Just not going to do it. Will not let it happen. Doesn't matter what this FBI investigation finds. Doesn't matter how incriminating. And keep in mind, the emails we keep sorting through are the pre-selected emails that Hillary already decided to let us see. We can't even see the really good stuff. It's gone. And maybe the FBI's found it. Maybe they haven't. But there's some pressure to appoint a special prosecutor and have Loretta Lynch step aside. I think you can all assume that that's not going to happen, that she's unwilling to do that, because then there'd be nobody in place to protect Hillary. And that's essential. If you believe that Barack Obama, through his 8 years, has accomplished much of what the progressive wish list has been, you need a Hillary presidency in order to continue that legacy. So even if you don't like Hillary Clinton, I don't know what Loretta Lynch thinks of Hillary Clinton personally. I have no idea. Even if there's some it's clear, I think the Obama administration is not that, or not the Obama administration, President Obama himself is not that fond of Hillary Clinton. But I do think he is enough a man of the left and a narcissist enough when it comes to his legacy that he would be willing to do whatever is necessary, including putting pressure on Loretta Lynch to make sure there's no charges brought against Hillary. And keep in mind that on a worst case basis, Obama could just pardon her. And Democrats would be okay with that. I know some of the country would be up in arms, but a lot of Democrats would just say, it's like Benghazi, it's a right-wing conspiracy, it's all gone now, pardon, what are you going to do about it? It's all legal. So, unfortunately, this isn't heading anywhere other than that. Join me tonight at 7 Eastern on the Blaze TV if you can. And in the meantime, no matter what, shields high.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.